Okay, obviously I'm giving the lecture today, and Jan, it turns out, his father recently died. I don't know if you know him, Daniel Schemmler was his father, who's the head of LBL, a member of the Academy, and professor at Berkeley. Anyways, so he'll be back in a while, and I'm depending on our schedules, he may give a lab tour and so forth. But I will start today. We'll be talking about diffusion, and we'll be talking about this time and the next time that I lecture, although this schedule is a little bit complicated. First thing is finish up the midterm. Apparently, you had some difficulty on the last problem. And your grades were fairly poor. And so what I've decided to do is the last problem I've assigned as homework, since you might as well learn it. And so it is assigned officially today, though in fact I think it was last Friday, and it is due, and there should not be any question marks, this Friday at 5 p.m. March 28th. If you turn it in and you do it properly or whatever, I will give you some fraction of your new score added onto your midterm, and then I'll let you know what your final midterm is. Also, homework number 9 is assigned. Actually, it's assigned today, but it's due April 4th, which is a ways from now. It's A, to give you some time to work on the midterm problem, also that you have your lectures coming up. This Wednesday, I will not be here because I'll be away, and we'll have Klaus Schulten talk about magnetic compasses. Last year, this was quite popular, so I asked him to come back, so I think you will enjoy it. Continuing on, we have the talks. The talks will be this Sunday, March 30th, and also Monday, March 31st. On Sunday, it will be from 6 to 8:30 p.m. I expect everyone to be here, in that I will ask you to do an evaluation of the people giving the talk, so your input is important. So about half the class will be presenting that night. You'll give a talk for 10 to 12 minutes, plus something like 2 minutes for questions. It will be Janet, Rue, Tyler, Dan, and Z, and Michael. And, oh, also, Sukrit, be ready in that you may be going that night, or you may, in fact, be the next day. I will have pizza for everyone. What I presume by this point you all like Papa Dell's. Yes? Always the expensive one. Is there anybody who's a vegetarian here? Just one? Really? Okay. I will have a vegetarian in part for you. And then Sukrit, Duskitin, David, Brian, Zoe, and Mustafa will be on Monday. And then, on Monday, April 7th, to show you what a guy I am, since he has the biophysics qualifying exam hit on like March 30th, he'll be giving his at the beginning of class on April 7th. Is there any questions? I strongly recommend that with your talks you go back and look at the outline of which I recommended you give the talk in terms of, you know, you motivate it, why it's of interest, you tell what it is, you tell what the conclusion, and then, oh, I think I said this, either at the end or at the beginning, you should have a one-sentence summary of the entire presentation. Okay, is there any questions? Okay, so for today, we are going to talk about diffusion. In fact, this will be the topic of today, and as I mentioned, the next time that I give a lecture, so we are pretty much finished with microscopy. And in general, what I want to say about diffusion is that for small things, and we'll talk about what's small, diffusion is a great way to get around. Basically, you have a small molecule here, and a water molecule is at temperature T, it's banging around, and it smashes into your guy and tends to make it go one way. Of course, diffusion also tends to go the other way. So on average, it doesn't get you anywhere. But if you're just sitting around and you're at a place and you need to come to another place that is not so far away, it's a good way of getting there. Now, if you have somewhat larger things, you need directed motion, which we've talked about. And some of the things that we're going to answer is how fast are small molecules moving in a cell, how often do things come in contact, are chemical reactions rates limited by, yeah, we have, okay. why don't you tap it? Okay. Okay, also random diffusion, it turns out, has a lot to do with the cell size, and also it has to do with a lot of literally breathing and the size of the capillary tubes. And how fast can cells produce a response? All of these things are limited by diffusion. And the important thing to remember is that inertia does not matter for bacteria or anything that is so-called small and microscopic in size. And we'll go and talk about why that is. Okay. The place to begin a discussion about diffusion is the equipartition theorem. And tell what does the equipartition theorem say? You guys should know this. Raise your hand if I can call on you. Some of you are like studiously walking away, looking away. Okay, Sukrit. Okay, that's it. For each degree of freedom, it turns out that depends, with the energy depends on the degree of freedom squared. So that it depends on the distance squared or depends on the velocity squared. You get a half a kT of energy. So in this case, if you have like something like with a block on a spring, so the potential energy depends on 1/2 kx squared. So you'll get a half a kT there for each degree of freedom. So, So if you just take a molecule that's not attached by anything, it's moving with some velocity v, so 1/2 v squared, mv squared, so it gets a half a kT in v sub x, half a kt in V sub y and half a kt in V sub z. So a molecule here floating freely in solution will have 3/2 kT of average energy. It's random, that is, it's not going in any particular direction, but it has that. Okay? And it's basically because water molecules or air molecules or whatever are banging into it. Okay, and K happens to have this value, and at room temperature like 300 degrees, KT is like 4.2 times 10 to the minus 1 joules, and joule is a newton meter. And a newton, what I remember, is it's about a quarter pounder. And if you want to be extreme, actually, a newton is a fifth of a pound. But a quarter pound is close enough. Okay? So what is the velocity of water molecules at room temperature? Good, good. Go solve it for me. Let me have a couple of guesses. How fast do you think it is? Just guess. You don't have to be right. I'm just curious. Mustafa, how fast do you think it is? A water molecule. Okay, so. Z, how fast do you think it is?
Very small.
Okay. Anybody want to say very large? Okay. Good. Yeah. Do it in miles per hour. I have a better sense of what a mile per hour is like rather than a meter per second. Tell you what, do it in both meters per second and miles per hour. How is that? You have it? Come on. You have 1 minute. Do you have it? Seconds. Five seconds. 2 seconds. 1 second. Okay. What's the answer? Do you have it? 216. What'd you get?
830,000
meters per second. Boy, you got. So you got what?
216
meters per second? And you got 830,000? Okay, so far we clearly have very large. Okay, do we get any very small? What'd you get? 642? Okay, and how many miles per hour is this? Did you? 13 what? Okay. That's what I claim is the correct answer.
Can I change? Sorry. I asked you if you assume it's a has 3 XYZ, you use that. But we think it's just half of KT.
Why is it just half a KT?
But why you think is because it has X, Y, Z, and
right?
I'm not sure you can add like this. You need to keep it separately for some X direction, Y direction, Z direction, and then do square root some of them together and then get it off. That's a very different answer. It should not be six because just 3 times of the number.
Okay. I'll let you think about it. But in any case, it's going 600, 200 miles per meters per second, which is going like, 1,000 miles per hour. Isn't that sort of amazing? So now the question is, how far does the water molecule go before it hits another water molecule? So the thing's going like crazy. It's going 1,000 miles per hour. So how far does it go? How do you figure it out? Good. You have the average distance between two molecules. How do you determine that?
Based on the density.
Good. Based on the density. What's the density of water?
1 gram per centimeter.
Okay. And so you need to convert that to the number of molecules on average per centimeter cubed. You take the cube root of it. And so you get some average distance that it goes before it hits the other guy, and you take that and divide it by meters per second, and you get seconds. Okay? That's basically what we have. The D, it's called the mean free path, divided by the velocity, the density of water, and the collision time ends up being like a picosecond. Very, very, very short. So it's going really fast, it's going for a picosecond, and then it's going really fast in another direction. Okay? So the water molecules undergo a random walk, and they're very, very fast. Okay, now let's talk about longer distances. Okay? And that diffusion is like a random walk, in the sense of if you say that it's x equals 0, and then it moves this way, and then moves that way, and then moves this way, and so forth. Okay, so the probability, it starts out, for example, as a delta function at x equals 0, and then slowly it will get broader and broader, and the width here increases. So at t equals 0, the probability that x is 0 is 1, and the probability that x is not 0 is equal to 0. Okay. And so the average value, we're going to be looking at the average value, because any one value is random. At 0, and then it equally likely moves left and moves right. Okay, so what we could do is we could look at the absolute value of x. It turns out that's a little bit awkward. More convenient is looking at the average value of x squared. So you know at t equals 0, this is equal to 0. And at later times, since here the average value of x squared does not depend on the sign, that t is not going to, at later time t, where t is not 0, the position x squared is not 0. Okay, and basically what x squared tells you about is the width of the distribution. That is, if it's linear in time, x goes like vt, which we have for molecular motors, but for diffusion we have something that looks very different. In particular, that it looks like the square root of time. What we're going to derive is x squared, the average value of x squared, looks like a number, depending on the dimensions, times a constant times t. So if we want to know the average distance, we take the square root. So the distance goes as the square root of time. And this number, this proportionality that I mentioned, is a function of the dimension. If you do a 1D diffusion, it's the number 2. If you do a 2D diffusion, it's a number 4. And if you do a 3D diffusion, it's the number 6. Janet, you look confused.
No, because I'm just trying to figure out why.
Oh. Well, actually, we'll, to a certain extent, derive these, but in fact, I'm going to give you one as homework. Okay. Okay, one thing that's important is that the distance squared goes as time, so the distance goes as the square root of time. So if in 1 second it's gone a distance x1, in 2 seconds it's only gone the square root of 2 times x1. So what does this mean in terms of the efficiency of getting there? If you need to get there in a very small period of time, where t is much less than 1, it gets there quite rapidly. If you need to move a long distance, it gets there very, very slowly. A molecular motor will get there linearly with time, but diffusion, it will take the square root of time, which is essentially forever. Okay, so let's derive the fact that it is equal to number times a constant times time. Okay? So what we're going to do is we assume that it's equally likely to step right or to step left. We assume that it takes steps of length L every tau seconds. This is obviously a crude approximation, but it turns out it's actually very well. It works very well. And if we move when it's free, it moves with velocity V. Or V, yeah. And also, we say it takes R steps per second and a total of N steps. Okay? Okay. Okay, so this says that we're going to derive what the mean or the average property is and also the standard deviation. So position after n steps is x sub n, and position after n plus 1 steps is x times sub n plus 1. So x sub n plus 1 is equal to x sub n plus or minus L. And the average value of x sub n is equal to the average value of x sub 0, which is equal to 0. Okay? Okay. So what is the value of x sub n? The average value? It's 0. But by symmetry, it's equally likely to move left and right. Okay? So now we want to write this. X sub n squared is some function of x sub n minus 1 and some function of L. What is that equal to? Go and talk about it. You have 1.5 minutes. You can talk to each other, it's okay. This is a function of that squared or L squared or plus or minus. Yeah, what? You're right now deriving the diffusion equation. Thank you. You have another 30 seconds. Okay. Give it. Somebody give me the answer. Tyler, do you think you know? How do you get that? Nobody knows, huh? People are still busy working away. Should I give you the answer? So x sub n is just x sub n minus 1 plus or minus l quantity squared. Right? Hold on. Okay. And so x sub n squared is equal to x sub n to the minus n minus 1 squared plus or minus 2 times l times x sub n minus 1 plus l squared. Yeah? Okay, so how do you simplify this? Is there anything? Yeah.
The middle one goes to zero.
The middle one, that goes to zero? Why is that?
Why? Because x of n minus 1, the average, is equal to x of n minus average. Because
the, n goes
large.
Right, the average, exactly, is zero. Because there's symmetry. It can go that way or it can go that way. This is, remember, the average value of x sub n minus 1.
I mean, it depends on its odd number or even number. If you take odd step or even step, if it's a even number, there's no way you can get zero because it's step left, step right. You must take two steps to get to the original position. If you take three steps, you cannot ever go back to our
the, this is the average value.
I'm talking about average value. Because right. You can take right and left. If I take three steps, how can I go back to zero?
Yeah, for as he says, in general for n being large, for example, you'll have equal number of left and equal number of right. So the error becomes, you know, infinitely small, the fact that there happens to be, you know, either an even or an odd number. So this becomes infinitely small, essentially zero. Okay, so then you have x sub n squared is equal to x sub n minus 1 squared plus l squared. Notice this is always a plus because whether it's plus or minus, squared is always a plus. Okay? So then we're left with this. Okay, so we're... So we want to get to something like this. Okay. So let's plug in some particular values for this. Let's say n is equal to 1. So that's x sub 1 squared is equal to x sub 0 squared plus l squared. Then let's n equals to 2. In that case, x sub 2 squared is equal to x sub 1 squared plus l squared. But that's equal to x sub 0 squared, this, substituted in, plus 2l squared. X sub 3 is equal to x sub 2 quantity squared plus l squared, but that's equal to x sub 0 squared plus 3l squared. So we can keep doing this, and in fact, for some large number n, x sub n squared is equal to x sub 0 squared plus n times l squared. It's starting to look like this. If you take x sub 0 from either side, in general, actually, we usually let this be equal to 0, but this is letting x sub 0 be some constant amount. This minus this is equal to nl squared. Actually, I shouldn't have this square root. So x sub, or delta x sub n squared, the difference of the distance from you started with, is equal to nl squared. That is, the average distance moved, the square root of this, is the square root of n times l. So we've just gone through an incredibly simple derivation of essentially the diffusion equation. You can actually do this with significantly more complicated partial differential equations, but there's really no need to do that. Okay? Now we have a little bit of really, it's just very simple algebra in terms of to write it as, you know, some other number times d squared. Okay, we said the average distance moved is the square root of n times d. So n is the number of steps per second times the time. So we said that is equal to r times the time, which is the same thing as the time over tau, if you prefer. Okay, so in that case, the distance squared is equal to, how does it go? How do we do this? Oh yeah, the distance squared is nl squared, so n is what? Is RT, RT what? Oh, RT times L squared, and R is T over tau. Okay. So in other words, the distance goes as both the square root of the number of steps, or in this case, the square root of number of times, the square root of time. Okay, and then you can let something you call d be equal to r times l squared over 2. The 2 is just sort of convenience. Okay? And then in that case, then x squared, the average value, is equal to 2 times d times tau. That is, in one dimension. In two dimensions, it's going to go like 4, and in 3 dimensions it's going to go like 6 dt. The important thing here is the diffusion constant looks like this is distance, this is time, this is distance squared, this time. So the diffusion constant looks like a distance squared divided by time, or like in microns squared per second. Okay? And so you basically have this, it's initially very sharply spiked, and then it spreads out. And I remind you, if a particle is undergoing diffusional walk, that it takes twice as far to go for 4 times larger. And in fact, just certain values, d is, for example, on the order of 250 or 300 microns squared per second. That's for a small molecule in water. So in fact, this is very relevant. Let's say you have a nerve, 2 nerves touching each other. And the way they communicate is they actually are not touching each other. There's actually a little space in between. And what happens is a nerve, there's some electricity in a nerve, and it basically opens up little vesicles right on the edge of the nerve. And the vesicles, they open up and they let small molecules out. That's all they do. And the small molecules then diffuse across the synapse. And it turns out the synapse is sufficiently small. Namely, it's about 100 nanometers in size. So simply by diffusion, this produces some small molecules which diffuse on, and then once they diffuse there, they undergo a further chemical reaction which causes the nerve, the next nerve, to propagate. How long it takes to do this? If you say that, for example, this is 100 nanometers or 0.1 microns, you square that, x squared equals 2 dt, so this squared is 0.01 squared is equal to 2 times about 250 microns squared per second times time, and the time is about 20 microseconds for one nerve to stimulate another nerve. Turns out that is that significant in terms of the amount of time that a nerve takes? You know, if you feel pain, for example, you touch something hot, you know, it needs to run up and eventually fire something in your nerve, which then fires something back, which then tells your nerve, your muscle, to contract and move your hand away. Turns out that this is sufficiently fast that it is not does not limit your ability to move your hand away.
This number consistent, like when that just said, young number, you have something hot and you react, it takes about 0.1 second for every person to react like this.
Is that right?
I'm just wondering if it's consistent, if we can calculate this with how many neurons going.
Yeah, essentially this is not consistent in that this is sufficiently fast that this is not rate limiting. Okay. So in fact, this here is just an electron micrograph of two nerve cells touching each other, and right here is this space between them. Okay. So remember, x squared is equal to some number times d times tau. So if the molecule gets bigger, does d go up or down? I always find this rather confusing. So as the object gets larger, d apparently evidently goes down. Why is that? Yeah.
Your velocity that you're getting from the equipartition was the inversely dependent on the mass. So if you had a bigger mass, you get lower velocity, right? Which kind of feeds into this d.
Why does it feed into the d?
Wouldn't that be determining what how fast you can move, then how fast you can take those steps, so it would, you know, affect that r? I mean, it kind of, you know, gets built up. It all depends on how fast you can take a step, right? And it determines on how much energy you have at the equation theorem.
I mean, you look at the ground in motion. Big particles that don't move, small particles move around. Basically, this diffusion is the ground in motion, transportation, long by. Of course, big particles stay here.
Okay. If you feel comfortable, great. Okay. And by the way, I used like 250 microns squared per second. That's true. That's for a small molecule like sucrose or the neurotransmitters. For example, for oxygen, it's about 1,000 microns squared per second. And this is actually very important because how long does it take for O2 to go from the edge of the cell to a middle? To the middle. Okay, so let's say a typical cell is 20 microns. So that means X, we want to go from here to the middle. X is like 10 microns. Okay? So what is the time? How do you figure out how long does it take for oxygen to go from the edge to the middle? Hello. Did somebody say something?
1 second.
Well, how do you figure it out? See?
Just use the diffusion equation.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you do with the diffusion equation?
Because you know, distance is 10 micrometers.
Yeah.
So x squared is 100 micrometers squared.
Okay. Okay.
So just over 6/1,000.
Okay. Great. And you get the time. Right. And so you get about 16 milliseconds. That's interesting. So this is sort of the typical size of a cell. Why can a cell be, I don't know, 10 times larger, or 100 times larger, or 1,000 times larger?
Take way too much time to move
things. What do you mean
or
by that?
To move around in the cell, for things to diffuse.
Yeah. What? What? I mean, things move in a cell often by directed motion. And so directed motion can move you a long way. In this case, though, the cell does need oxygen to survive. And it would take too long if the cell was really, really big. If it was a millimeter, let's say, or 10 millimeters or something like that. And in fact, there are some cells that are, in fact, like 1 to 2 millimeters in size. What's that?
I mean, human eye is
1 millimeter. Is it?
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. I didn't know that. It turns out a frog egg, a frog cell, is about 1 to 2 millimeters in size. It is absolutely enormous. They are the coolest cells going. They really are. And in fact, they can be so huge. They're like 1 to 2 millimeters in size because, in fact, these cells are extremely inactive. Mostly, they just basically sit around. They don't have a lot of things going on, so they don't need a lot of oxygen. So therefore, they can be very large. But if you have the more active a cell is, the smaller it tends to be. And in fact, bacterial cells, which are tend to be on the order of a micron size, where eukaryotic cells are, you know, 10 or 100 times as large, bacterial cells can be much more active in general than a eukaryotic cell. Okay. Another example, and I'll give this to you, pretty sure, as a homework problem, is when you breathe. You have these air sacs, which are called alveoli, and these are typically about 100 microns in size. And this is where oxygen comes, and it is very close to capillaries. And capillaries are sufficiently small that an individual blood cell runs through them. So the question is, oxygen needs to get from here to here, and CO2 from here to here. And it does this purely by diffusion. And in fact, I'll give you a bit of a problem showing that oxygen and CO2 diffuses fast enough that, in fact, as the capillary is moving past the alveoli, it can give up its CO2 and take oxygen fast enough such that the diffusion works just fine. Is really amazing. Okay. Okay, why don't we take a 3-minute break, and then we'll go on to the efficiency of diffusion, and we'll also talk about bacteria and how fast they can move around. Yes.
I told you something last year that you can actually there's actually a titration curve for oxygen, and it's in that middle range that oxygen is actually deadly. So for stuff like suspended animation type stuff, they actually poison the oxygen processes to drop the oxygen into like a new safe regime where there's a depleted level of oxygen. They use stuff like hydrogen sulfide.
You were saying, why do they want to deplete it of oxygen?
Well, for person type things. I was reading about suspended animation, and there's a danger zone where you have radical oxygen, or like a low amount of oxygen that will just attack things. But if you replace that with something like an oxygen substitute, like hydrogen sulfide, it will outcompete the oxygen, so you drop into a new safe level where oxygen isn't damaging your cells.
Okay. Did you?
Cool.
Assume that every position at the D step is N step is 0. At N minus 1 step, it will never be 0. It will be minus L or plus L. That will affect this result a lot. I don't know why you can assume both to be exactly 0. If you think it's random work, left, right, left, right, you must discuss it from the old number, even number of a step, and minus one, and then plug
well, the number in. Yeah, but when you take the average value.
Average value, for example, if you assume it's an even number for a step n, n is an even number, it is zero, that is true. But for n minus one, it can be plus L or minus L. That number is comparable to the.
But not that not the average value.
You assume the average step x minus 1. Because you assume two things. If you assume the average of the n is 0, then n minus 1 will not be 0.
No, that's not true. For any specific case that x sub n might be 0 and therefore n minus 1 or n plus 1 is not equal to 0, right?
Yeah.
But in terms of, do you take the average value?
Yeah. But if the n is, for example, n is 2n plus 1, I mean, that take a
okay.
old what? Number step. It will never come back to origin.
Yeah, the average, you're looking as the
average value.
No, you're looking at the specific. You know, you're mm-hmm. saying it's taking over here, and you're
looking at a specific process. It's a random process. You're looking at one step, specific trace.
Okay, let me okay. just get that then. Okay, so now we're going to get to a potential problem with our derivation, in that we said x squared is equal to some number times dt. So if we want to look at the distance moved as via diffusion goes as the square root of time, so the average goes like ddt of the square root of x squared. And that is ddt of x squared, which is equal to 2dt. So x dx dt is equal to d. I just take a derivative. So dx dt is equal to d over x, which is I see. that x is equal to the square root of dt, which is, so this is then equal to the square root of d over tau. So it says that the instantaneous velocity is very fast for short times. But it also says, as t goes to zero, the velocity goes to infinite. That is, don't you have a problem with special relativity? So as t goes to zero, v goes to infinity. So what is happening here? Secret. So this velocity goes as this 1 over the square root of time. So if time goes to 0, the velocity gets infinitely fast. We know it doesn't get infinitely fast. So what is the problem with t going to 0? What is this model assuming? Go ahead.
Once time becomes more than the collision time, then nonsense.
That's right. This doesn't apply for anything less than the collision time. And that's correct. Okay. Experimentally, how do you measure D? What you do, let's say you look at a particle and it's floating around. So what you do is you plot the distance, let's say, just call, you start to look t equals 0, and then you look at some time t naught later and get the value of x naught. Then you look at time t1 later and get x1 and so forth. And you plot the distance as a function of the square root of time. And in fact, there you should get a straight line. We'll plot the distance squared versus time, or take the square root of them. And either way, it gives you a linear relationship, and the slope of that line is the diffusion constant. I think between Janice and Sukrit, they always, I feel like I cause them a lot of pain.
No. I just had homework yesterday, and it's about diffusions from other class.
Oh,
but then D turned out to be very small, so I'm confused. So you said D is 1,000 centimeters squared per second. What I did is about 14, and it got d to be 10 to negative 8 centimeters squared per second.
Something's wrong. Did you have a question?
Well, and then when we were talking about his homework, we were arguing whether you can take a experimental set of data and extrapolate it, or and try to find an average value, use the x values as if it's an excitation value of x, which is exactly what you're saying right now.
Yes.
Can you explain why you can do that?
Well, it. I don't know. You have this, and you're taking the average value. And I mean, what does this mean? This is, you take some value of x, you know, and you take its average value. The question is, have you taken a long enough time to let this be the average? You know, you can imagine taking it every picosecond or something like that, and that wouldn't be valid because we said it has to undergo, you know, multiple collisions. But it's pretty unlikely that you're going to take it every picosecond. So, okay, you take it every second, let's say. Well, that's plenty of time to call it the average, and that's equal to 6 dt. So the answer is go back in your calculation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, okay.
I know Einstein did this in like 1905 or something. They must not have had very fast acquisition of time. Did they do this by eye, or did they use like a radioactive particle or something to track it on carbon paper? Or how do they actually track this?
I don't know.
Okay.
Although, even in 1905, you did have microscopes, and so you could look at a bacteria, for example, moving, and you'd get something like this. Okay, so what we said initially is diffusion is good for small distances, but it's not good for bringing you from point A to point B, and for that you need molecular motors. Okay, now for the next 10 minutes or so, we'll talk about how bacteria move. The question is bacteria small enough that this kind of diffusion matters, okay? And it turns out the bacteria, it lives in what's called a low Reynolds number world, and we'll talk about it a little bit. So bacteria, just to give you a sense of scale, is about like 1 micron and typically about 3 microns long. And it often has a flagellar tail, which is beating fast, and then it goes forward. And turns out it goes about 25 microns per second. That's just what it does. So that means it goes about 10 body lengths per second. Where if you compare it to you, if you assume, for example, you walk at 4 miles per hour, that's reasonable. Turns out that's 6 feet per second. So that's about a body length per second. So bacteria are not just walking, they're, you know, in that sense, they're running really fast. Or if you look at swimming, for example, if you take an Olympic swimmer, they go about a body length a second, about 6 feet per second. And so what? And so they're going a body length per second, where the bacteria is going 10 body lengths per second. So this is, you know, one serious swimmer. Okay, but let's say you're going along with your tail, and then all of a sudden you shut off your tail. The question is, how far does bacteria coast? And of course, you use F equals ma to try to do this. A is dv dt, so that's m dv dt. Remember, you no longer have the flagella moving. So then the force on you is just the friction of the water. And that's equal to a number, gamma, which is called the drag coefficient, times the velocity. So, and basically, it's linear in V at low speeds. So we don't have to worry about turbulence or anything like that. Okay? So what does gamma depend on for bacteria or anything, for that matter, floating?
The size.
The size, and what else?
The viscosity.
And the viscosity. That's right. So the viscosity and the dimensions of the objects. So it's equal to eta times d, the dimension of the object, and the force times the velocity, with some number that tells about the exact shape. It turns out for a sphere, that's equal to 6 pi. It's just a number, it doesn't really matter. So the drag is equal to 6 pi eta times r. Okay, so you actually solve the differential equation, mdv dt, ma is equal to minus gamma v. So v is equal to v naught e to the minus gamma t over m. So tau is equal to m over gamma. That's the amount of time that it takes to go about, to decrease to about a third of your initial velocity. What is the mass of the bacteria? Well, it's roughly the volume times the density. It's about 1 micron in size, and the density is pretty close to that of water. And so this is gamma. And you plug in the numbers, and you get tau is equal to 200 nanoseconds. So it's going at like 25 microns per second. It shuts off its propeller, and then it goes, it basically stops in 200 nanoseconds. That's extremely fast. So once forces are turned off, bacteria forget about history very quickly. That's another way of saying the bacteria does not care about its inertia at all. So how far does the bacteria coast in these 200 picoseconds, 200 nanoseconds? It turns out that you find that the bacteria coasts less than a hydrogen atom. It's absolutely amazing. So it's going along, swimming at 10 times what we swim at. It shuts off. It does not care at all about its inertia, because in 200 nanoseconds, or in basically less than an angstrom, the thing stops. So the inertia is irrelevant to bacteria. So in contrast to you, inertia matters to you, because you're swimming along and you stop kicking and you stop swimming, and you still go a little bit. You, I don't know, typically go about one body length, or actually probably more. So inertia matters to you. Okay, what is the size of the drag force on the bacteria? So we say the velocity is going about 25 microns per second. It then stops in about 200 nanoseconds. So that means the force is delta P delta T. Delta P is the mass times the initial velocity minus the final velocity, which is zero, divided by 0.2 microseconds. So that's 5 times 10 to the minus 13th, or 0.5 piconewtons. How does that compare to its weight? Well, its weight is just equal to mg, which is this mass times g, is 0.04 piconewtons. So the bacteria is swimming as if it's dragging about 10 times its own weight. So this bacteria is a pretty damn amazing thing. I mean, it's swimming really fast against like a huge force, namely 10 times its own weight. If it shuts off, it stops immediately. Okay, so you've learned all the wonders of bacteria. By the way, in the homework that I've assigned, it's largely about optical traps, and we don't have Jan's lectures because he's busy, but we put up some of my old lectures about optical traps on the web, and that should do you.